Welcome, everybody, to episode 148 of the Metabolist 2 podcast, which is featuring myself, Ben.
And David. And tonight we are going to discuss the haunting of the Villa Diodati.
Ooh, it's a ghost, scary ghost.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah, I saw this episode live-ish, I guess, at Gallifrey 1.
For the first time, yeah.
For the first time, with a room full of literally, I don't know, probably like 1,000 people.
And it went over well, is what I recall you saying.
Everyone really enjoyed it. Mm-hmm. Which means I actually missed bits of it, because people were like whooping and talking and laughing and stuff when I was doing, I'm trying to watch this, my show. I liked it. I thought it was great.
Yeah, there is really not much, if anything, to fault on it. It's a
not really
pretty robust story.
Yeah, I mean, I think the only things to fault on it are kind of pretty standard Doctor Who things, which we're kind of used to. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I don't know, random historical characters doing proper Doctor Who-y things, mm-hmm. you know. But it was creepy and it was scary, right. And the lone Cyberman. I'm not sure why Captain Jack didn't just say, don't give a Cyberman a Siberium when he asks for it, because that's the same amount of words.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, I guess prophecies from the inverted commas future are always a kind of a bit garbled. So
yeah.
Maybe just don't give him what he wants is, mm-hmm. I thought it was well directed. I thought it was very well acted. There was an ensemble cast, but I didn't feel that anyone had not enough to do, which is often the case when you get a lot of people involved.
Mm-hmm.
And I would be hard to find anything wrong with this one.
Mm-hmm.
Hard pressed.
This was Emma Sullivan's second outing. She did last week's Can You Hear Me? So this is her second Doctor Who that she directed.
Right.
And first time writer Maxine Alderton. And I think they both combined to make this drama that really expanded upon what we know about Cybermen in a very similar but yet different way than Moffat did with A World Enough in Time in The Doctor Falls. We have this partial Cyberman, Ashad.
Who seemed to me to be a mixture of Moffat / 10th Planet Cyberman.
Yeah.
Kind of Gaiman, Neil Gaiman Cyberman. And his legs looked like that they were alternative universe Cybermen.
Yes, very much so, with the flares.
Yeah. So very kind of very 2005, 2006.
Yeah. And like you had mentioned in our last podcast, you had totally predicted we'd see the lone Cyberman early.
Yeah.
And that wasn't so much a surprise. The surprise was the humanity of the lone Cyberman, of Ashad.
Yeah. But I mean, I think what was scary about him is that you say that, you know, his humanity, but of course his humanity kind of manifested itself in its inhumanity. You know, he was a cruel, horrible, laughing,
sadistic,
nasty man.
Mm-hmm.
So it was all the worst bits of humanity, not the best bits.
Right. Yeah, exactly. So
yeah,
that combined for a monster that really doesn't show up until the last maybe 10-15 minutes of the story. Up until that point, the ghost story aspect is all Shelley. It's all Percy Bysshe Shelley, who's controlling the villa and folding it in on itself, trying to protect the Cybrarian or Siberium. I kept thinking of the Cybrary or whatever.
I keep thinking of the Siberiad. Is that a thing? Is that a Doctor Who thing?
Hmm.
Anyway, yes. And I'm not sure why it should be a Siberium. What is a Siberium?
It seems like it's kind of a computerized matrix for Cybermen that's somewhat living metal that fuses with a brain that takes it over.
Yeah, what was the
thing? It was burning out, Shelley.
What was the thing that was in the next Doctor?
Yeah, I don't recall. Info stamp?
Yeah, I should have looked that up, because that was a thing that Cybermen do. I did like the kind of sort of Lord of the Rings style Percy Shelley, you know, picks up the Siberian from the from the bottom of the lake kind of thing. And it takes him over and he becomes all hiding in the basement.
My precious.
Yeah, my precious. And yeah, here comes the Cybermen. It was great. Yeah, it was good. I mean, I thought, you know, I mean, I knew a little bit about the Villa Diodati, but not a huge amount. And just doing some poking around, you know, obviously the Polidori was a sleepwalker.
Yes.
That's the thing that he was. So they kind of, that was, I thought, very well integrated.
Very high-strung character.
Yeah. And he was always challenging people to duels. But, I mean, I thought, that, you know, the whole perception filter thing, and he's a sleepwalker, so the perception filter doesn't work.
Right.
That, I thought, was like, that's some awesome plotting right there. You take a characteristic of a real-world character, and that helps our made-up characters solve their mystery. That's some good writing, basically. That's some good writing right there.
Yeah, there was a lot of good writing like that. And another good bit of Alderton's writing was having William Shelley, Mary and Percy's child, in there. In most gothic horrors that deal with the origin of Frankenstein, conveniently omit that Mary Shelley was a very young woman, I think 18 or so, and had a four-month-old child that she was...
Yeah, that they were looking after, exactly. And the child becomes, you know, an important part of the story, which I thought was good as well.
Yeah.
You know, so yeah, I'm not only do you have the four, well, I guess Shelley's sort of missing, but, you know, you have the inhabitants of the villa, but you've also got a child as well, you know, which is another character to kind of shoehorn into the story, which was great.
And I liked, even though it wasn't really driven character development for the fam, that each of them, Graham, Ryan, and Yaz, all had something a little bit different to do. Graham, we had the comedy bit again. That seems to be the go-to for anything for Graham, trying to find the toilet.
And... Which was hilarious, actually, to be honest.
Okay. Super funny. So that played well in L.A. then?
Yeah. No, everyone was hooting with laughter at Graham's kind of, you know, Graham's comedy. Yeah.
And the always being surprised by the valet or the other staff of the villa being scared witless by that. I think that was another bit that he did really well.
And kudos here, actually, for the writing. This is a very minor point that always irritates me. That was a valet. That was a valet that they had, not a butler.
Right.
Like in every other, especially American drama, it's like, it's the butler. It's not a butler. There's only one of them. It's a valet.
Right.
The butler is someone who's in charge of an entire house, and there's a lot of people that he looks after. So I that always really irritates me when they get the names of servants wrong.
So you were pleased that he identified himself correctly.
I was the one person who stood up in Hall A at Gallifrey 1 and literally applauded for about 2 or 3 minutes when that happened.
Excellent. And people are going, I wasn't. I'm trying to listen.
I didn't do that. What are you doing? What are you doing, you fool? Anyway, so that was a minor point. There you go.
Yeah. But again, a good bit of writing.
Good piece of writing. Yeah.
Alderton's part.
Yep. One thing, I mean, maybe we like the episodes so much that we're not kind of, you know, we're just kind of dotting around here a little bit. Well, I am certainly, as usual. But, I mean, Graham has this habit of seeing ghosts. So either it means ghosts are real, which I think pretty much Doctor Who has established. It's kind of, you know, in the Doctor Who, in the Whoniverse, ghosts aren't real.
Right.
Apart from when they are. Or there's something up with Graham. Do you think he's got a brain tumor or something? Hope not.
No. I think the cook and her daughter were actually real and part of the household staff. And since all of them were moving around very creepily and disappearing and stuff, I think those two were part of the staff. I don't think they're actually ghosts.
Oh, you don't think they were real ghosts?
No, I don't think any of the servants. Right. The only ghost was Bish Shelley.
Okay, all right.
That was my take on
it. Fair enough. That's your take on it. Okay. Yeah.
Well, I guess you don't agree. You don't like that interpretation.
Oh well, no. I'm just curious to see whether they are kind of setting up Graham for some kind of
nasty end.
I mean, they're setting up someone for some kind of something, aren't they, really? Aren't they? I mean, it seems to be that...
It seems to me that they're setting up Yaz to have her heart broken. I think she has a major crush on the Doctor, and her scene with Claire, just saying that Byron was no good, a little bit of a wandering eye. She deserves better. And then Claire kind of turning it around, asking her, about the doctor. It seemed to me that that was what they're setting up. Maybe I'm missing something bigger on Graham.
Yeah. Yeah. I don't know. I mean, yeah, it seems to me that there's something, I don't know. This seems like there's something going on.
The bit of foreshadowing that I picked up at the very end when the doctor is saying human and cyber wars don't mesh very well, don't work out very well. I'm wondering if we're going to see Cyber Graham or Cyber Ryan or one of them be cybernized. But you would think that Chibnall wouldn't want to tread that heavily on Moffat's final outing.
That is true, actually. I mean, there are, I mean, the pictures from this coming week show our heroes strapped to cyberization tables, ready to be cyberized. Spoiler alert. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's not really spoiler because they've released the pictures already. But you are right, actually. I mean, Moffat went pretty much full on with people being cyberized with Danny Pink. I guess the Brigadier.
Bill.
And Bill. And then I was going to come on to Bill. Some pretty major cyberization as a plot. So, but then again, I mean, that is what people want to see with Cybermen, don't they? A little bit. They want to see some cyberizing going on. And the Lone Cyberman is particularly kind of unpleasant looking with his either rust or blood or just something streaking his horrible body. Mm-hmm. And, you know, his single staring eye and all that kind of stuff. So,
yeah. So other bits I really liked, just going away from the Cybermen for next week, because we'll probably want to loop back on that. But the comedic bits with Ryan worked really well for me this time around, with the scene with the really painfully awkward chopsticks on the piano.
That was funny.
To just working in the duel, and I think it was it Fletcher who was the valet?
Yeah.
Being Polidori's second.
Right.
And inquiring if Graham was going to be Ryan's second, and Graham's going, no way, and Ryan's going, yeah, thanks, mate, for that, I thought. But the bit of humor I liked the most was when Yaz, Mary, and Ryan were on the stairs, and Ryan just freaking out because he thought he felt a ghost, and Yaz going, it was my elbow. And just Tosin Cole's eyes got really big as Ryan. He was just looking around, and that bit of humor, that kind of physical acting, I thought was really indicative of Ryan's really ready to believe anything type character.
Right, right.
And not servicing him very well at all.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, you know, it's a combination of the writing and obviously the directing, as I think I'm just repeating myself at this point. But, you know, I think I think everybody had good bits of business to do, which really, really helped. It just shows, you know, that actually if you pay attention with the writing, you can make a three companion TARDIS work.
Yeah.
And also have, you know, guest stars of a certain large number as well, because, you know, you got to give Byron and Polidori and Byron's girlfriend Claire and Mary and then Perth. I mean, you got to give everyone something to do, and I think it worked brilliantly.
Right.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And giving something for everyone to do, I liked how the romantics that's this period, right?
The romantic poets. Era. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, the romantic poets and their ensemble always calling her Mrs. Doctor. They just couldn't get their minds around that she was just simply the doctor. And I really liked Byron kind of oozing over on Whitaker's doctor, and she having nothing of it and always just saying, no, you may not, cutting him off and not entertaining entertaining this Casanova type character.
Yeah, she really doesn't like Byron, does she, at all?
No.
Yeah.
Shelley she likes, but not Byron.
Yeah, no, she's very, well, she likes Shelley enough to unleash a horror of a million cyber armies upon the universe to save his life. She likes him that much.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Yeah, but I thought it was really a good dynamic. The one disappointment, I guess, that we have here is if this For a large part, Whitaker plays it like Tennant in many, many ways.
Right.
And we've mentioned this in series 11, but we don't have any hanky panky in this TARDIS at all. We don't have a romance where we have a woman as the doctor, and there is no sparks of romance. There was no doctor and Madame Pompadour.
Right.
Here we have this lecherous poet and who's hitting on the doctor, and there's if the casting was reversed, we would have had that romantic scene. We would have had the girl in the fireplace type historical thing. And that's not what Chibnall's interested in, and he's been very consistent that's not what the Whitaker Doctor is about.
Yeah, which I think is slight double standard, really, a little bit. But, you know, fair enough.
It is, but I think with Whitaker, I think being with a rainbow stripes and being a LGBTQ...
icon of some kind.
Icon of some sort, having a heterosexual romance or even a flirtation is probably not the vibe, to use the word from the story, that they were going to include.
Yeah, I guess so. Yeah.
The one bit, if I had one criticism for this entire story, and I'm not sure what else you were going to do, but the killing off of only the historically insignificant people, as in the
right.
staff, the hired people, the nurse, or the I'm guessing she was a nurse for William, the nanny, the au pair, and then the valet, seemed a little mean-spirited. At least the valet, at least Fletcher, could have survived. He was just being thrown aside. I didn't like that only the people that we haven't heard about were the people that died.
Yeah, no, I agree with you there. I mean, I think, but as you point out, there's relative little you can do about that other than, I guess... Not kill anyone, or you could do the old kind of bait and switch thing where, I don't know, you kill Percy Shelley and then discover that actually... his place is taken by the butler, who's actually the real Percy Shelley or something, you know, that's just a bit too contrived. I mean, there's too much explaining for that to really kind of work well for a single episode show. The butler's secretly been writing poetry and actually is then able to kind of now be Percy Shelley for a bit.
It wouldn't have worked in this story. And
no,
you know, the doctor technically shows Shelley his death, drowning, you know, 10 years hence. But to me, it's the one bit I couldn't see how you could get out of it, because you want to have some stakes. You want to show that this Cyberman is dangerous and deadly.
Yep.
But you have these historical characters that you can't do anything to, and you're not going to do anything to your TARDIS team. So who's left is the servants, and it just seems unfair and kind of classist in a way.
But again, you know, I mean, it is the late early 19th century. The servants are kind of disposable, so fair enough.
Yeah.
So
sets up the ascension of the Cybermen next week.
Yeah, it does. I hope. I mean, obviously, Chibnall's got a bit of a, you know, he's like soured. He's got a thing for Cybermen.
Mm-hmm.
And is he writing the two final episodes?
Yeah. I think this is all a Chibnall production.
Yeah. So we started, you know, obviously last year's finale, if it could be called such a thing, Battle of Ansgar,
Rancid Colon, I think.
Whatever the thing is. Yeah. Not very impressive to my mind. Low stakes throughout. And boring returning villain. He's got two episodes to work on here. That's good.
Mm-hmm.
We'll see what he can do with it, I think.
Yeah.
I'm looking, and you know, not only we got the Cybermen coming back, obviously, but, you know, Captain Jack's going to have to come back, right? Because he knows about the lone Cybermen.
From what Chibnall said, he doesn't return this season at all. So he might come
back. The showrunner lies, though, doesn't he, sometimes?
Yeah, he does. But I honestly think that Barrowman was in there because he's friends with Chibnall, and Chibnall was showrunner for Torchwood, and Barrowman is begged and pleaded to come back.
To come back in again.
So
right.
There was just this cameo, a kind of a throwaway. It could have been anyone.
All right.
Why not bring Captain Jack in? He certainly wasn't significant to the story in anything. And really, the warning was pretty weak sauce when it came down to it.
It certainly was. As I pointed out, he could have been a lot more explicit about things that you shouldn't give to a lone Cyberman.
But you could have even done it without even having the warning, because the Doctor's inclination was not to give the Cybermen what the Cybermen wanted in the first place. And that is true.
I actually was reading a funny thread on Twitter when people were kind of pointing out that, of course, the Doctor's going to be suspicious of a Cyberman, because that's the kind of thing that the Doctor is suspicious of. And of course, if the Cyberman wants something, mm-hmm. you probably shouldn't give it to the Cybermen, because right. the Cybermen are the villains. Mm-hmm. So yeah, no, you are right. It was kind of a dumb warning.
It was there, I think, mainly to give Barrowman a cameo.
Fair, okay.
And if something did leak out a fugitive of the Judoon, it would have been great distraction if Barrowman's coming back, then the Joe Martin Doctor instead.
So that brings me on to my second desire for next week, or this coming week, is mm-hmm. we need some more Joe Doctor. Dr. Ruth, we need her back.
I agree. I think it's been a big letdown that we haven't seen her at all in like Praxeus or any of the other
Absolutely.
Subsequent stories. But I have an inclination we may not see her at all remaining series 12.
No, really? Oh, that makes me sad.
Yeah. Maybe Christmas? Maybe the Christmas special?
Maybe Christmas. It's but remember, Dr. Ruth is not just for Christmas, it's for all the time. There was an awesome Dr. Ruth cosplay at Gallifrey 1.
Yeah?
Yeah, very, very impressive to kind of whip that up so quickly.
How did she find the shirt? Or I'm assuming it was a she.
She
right?
had like a really amazing colored shirt, yeah. Mm-hmm. And a tailored blue jacket and everything. It was really, really good.
Excellent.
I saw her when we were out getting pizza with the podcasting people, mm-hmm. my new podcasting buddies. so didn't really get a snap because it was dark.
Right.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, that would be up on my Instagram as we speak. Okay, so we might not. So your feeling is we're not going to get Dr. Ruth back. How about the Master? Oh.
I don't think we're going to get the Master either.
No,
maybe.
Really?
Oh,
my God.
Maybe. I think we'll... I'm not sure. Maybe we'll get some kind of cameo or flashback
Gotta
of the
get
Master
something,
in the
please.
Timeless Children.
Right.
But I think next week is all following on Cyberman Tim Shaw. And,
Cyberman Tim Shaw.
and then probably... The 10th episode is the payoff, hopefully, of the Timeless Children.
Right. Goodness. Wow. I sincerely hope you're wrong, but
I could be
I kind of
well
suspect
right.
you're right, but we'll have to see.
Mm.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So
we'll see. I think this is what we've found much with Classic Who. When there is something this good, there's very little to pick apart on it.
Yes, you're right. I'm a little bit stumped. You know, even down to the kind of it's patently shot in Wales didn't bother me at all either. you know, I mean if that's supposed to be Lake Geneva, I'm a Dutchman, basically a Flying Dutchman, a lone Cyberman of some kind. But still, the irritation I had with it takes you away when you have to set it in Sweden or wherever, when again
right.
it's pretty obvious this is Wales again. Why not just right. set it in Wales as usual? Mm-hmm. I mean, that didn't bother me at all. I was, you know, rattled along. And as I said, you know, obviously, as soon as you start to poke at various bits, it starts to be a bit wobbly. But then it wouldn't be Doctor Who if, like, there weren't some wobbly bits. But this kind of standard stuff that we want from Doctor Who, we want threat, mm-hmm. we want spookiness. We want everyone treated well, i.e. every character gets something interesting and useful to do in terms of the plot and also in terms of their character. We're fans, so we'd like a returning monster if possible. But even if we don't get a returning monster, we want something spooky and in cool and new. It really ticked all of those boxes. It's an historical, we like historical stuff. It gave us mm-hmm. everything that we wanted, basically. I mean, again, you know, why was the Cyberman... Why was the lone Cyberman, you know, reanimating human skeletal hands?
It wasn't. It was Shelley.
True. Okay. Why was Shelley doing that again?
He was pissed off because no one could see him because of the cyberarium. Because they had that one cutaway scene where earlier in the show we saw him smashing the picture of Voss against the wall Voss, because the nurse couldn't see him. And so I think he was doing the same thing. And maybe he, I don't know if he actually physically was controlling the hand that attacked Ryan.
Right.
But I think his folding in of the house was causing these things to go cuckoo.
Fair. Okay. I will accept that explanation. I get.
Okay.
Was that made explicit? Did I just kind of miss that by not paying attention?
You might have missed it within the fans. Now, I think it was Shelley who was controlling that. I don't think it was the Cybermen. I don't think we really even see the Cybermen until we see the shimmery outline near the lake, and then we have the whole bit with the using lightning to recharge and kind of the Frankenstein monster mythos, and with Mary Shelley saying modern Prometheus. And,
right.
You know, still seeing a soul. So Alderton really worked in, I think, the little bits of hooks for the inspiration for Frankenstein in there. I think that worked in really well. But I think that the haunting, the ghostly bits was Shelley himself trying to protect himself from the Cybermen, but it was burning through his mind.
Right.
The other bit that really struck me out, even though I thought it was very predictable, that it was going to be that both parties, the Doctor, the Time Team, and the romantic poet family, were going to scare each other at the door because they both weren't what they were expecting. I thought that was handled so much better than what Neil Cross did in Hyde, where they did when the Doctor and Clara are at the door and they just do Ghostbusters.
Yeah.
You know, bit with Jessica Raine and Scott, Dougray Scott.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And I think everyone looked great in their costumes as well.
People were excited that the Doctor had the hood up too.
Doctor had a hood up. Graham looks great in a suit. Ryan looks good in a suit. Yaz was wearing a great period appropriate dress.
Funny hat.
Funny wearing a bonnet. Yeah, all that kind of stuff. Mm-hmm. All good stuff, basically.
Yeah, the costumes really, I think, have made a difference in the historicals and were, I think, a good course correction on Chibnall's part from Series 11. Put the Time Team in costumes. It works well.
Yeah, I mean having rewatched The Witchfinders, the Gallifrey one, you know, just seeing kind of Graham and his comedy hat.
Yeah.
And actually, in some ways, it emphasizes, you know, I mean, I think I don't know where we're really going to land on this Doctor's character aspect, you know, that we were discussing, you know, is she just a little bit maybe on some kind of spectrum and, you know, finds it hard to relate to people. I mean, it seems to me interesting, you know, that the Doctor is the one person who doesn't change her clothes.
Yeah.
And that, you know, that can be indicative of some kind of mental rigidity. Exactly. So, I mean, I don't know whether that's deliberate or not, but I mean, again, it's kind of maybe feeding into maybe that plot line, if it is a plot line a little bit, which I think is good.
I think it's Chibnall trying to have his cake and eat it too. He grew up in the 1980s with the uniformed TARDIS team with JNT, and I think with Whitaker being such an icon, if you put her in anything traditionally feminine or if you cross over into something really masculine, you fall off that tightrope. You stop walking that fine line. So by keeping the Doctor in her costume, mixing it up a little bit with the tuxedo, but still you have the same cut of you know, the short crop pants. You mix up her shirts. You have a maroon one. You have a blue one. Hood up, hood down. You have a little bit of variety. Not as much variety as Tom Baker's Doctor. But then Tom Baker had 7 years to work with.
Yeah. Mm. I would like to see Jodie in different clothes, but you know,
I would agree.
I guess I'm not going to get that, but, you know, we will see what happens.
Well, she has. It's the tuxedo. I mean, that's the extent.
That's true. That's true. She does wear a tuxedo. She does. She does know when to dress up.
Right. And she's the one who instructed the fam at the end of Can You Hear Me? That we're going to go see the Genesis of Frankenstein. You might as well, or you're probably going to want to dress up. So she knows. She chooses not to.
Genesis of the Frankenstein.
Yeah. So I think it's a marketing thing more than a character thing.
Yeah, fair enough. No, that's I think that's a fair enough. I think it's a good that analysis makes sense to me.
So are we good on Villa d'Arte?
I think we are. I mean, I said if only it was this good all the time, I'd be very, very happy, but it just shows it can be this good all the time if they really try.
Well, this series has been very good, though.
Oh yeah, no, it's light years. Do I mean light years? I do mean it's light years ahead of series 11 in my book. I'm nervous for the next couple of weeks because, you know, I desperately want this to be good.
Stick the landing.
Yeah, and actually, you know what? And it's funny. I mean, just thinking about it, I want it to be good because I personally want it to be good. I don't really care whether, you know, anyone else thinks it's good or not, you know what I mean?
Right.
I'm actually invested enough in this series to kind of actually want to have something that I really enjoy.
Right. I agree. I would really like the payoff that we've been dealt out here over the past 8 episodes.
Because we know they can do it now. I mean, I think the Battle of Ansgar, Boris Johnson, whatever it's called, you know, was like, I know it's crap because actually the most of it's been crap, so that's not really a surprise.
Right.
So it was sort of disappointing, kind of doubly disappointing. Mm-hmm. This series is able to deliver excellent episodes, so I want these last 2 episodes to be excellent.
And I want to see Graham walk out alive.
I want to see Graham die of a brain tumor. No, I don't. I want to see Ryan turned into a Cyberman. I want to see Yaz
That'd be what, the third
third cyberization,
right?
There you go.
Well, but the third person of color, to use the American term, to become cybernized.
Absolutely. I want to see Yaz become the Master's companion and do a total turlo on everybody. And I want the only companion to be left is Graham. And I want the Doctor and Graham to fly away and have adventures together.
Okay.
Okay, no, hang on. No, wait a second. The other thing I want to have happen, and this is kind of mean, and I don't really mean it, but I also want Jodie to be revealed as an alternative universe doctor and Dr. Ruth to take over as the real universe doctor. I don't think any of that's going to happen, but that's my kind of fan ending of series 12.
For whatever reasons, it could be having started a new job during the series or whatever, I'm not as invested, I think, as I was last year. So I'm more along for the ride than anything else. And I just would like it to be satisfying in some way.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I think last season I was just desperate for it to succeed.
Yeah.
Because we had a new showrunner and we had a new doctor, and the new doctor was a woman, which is like, people are like not liking it. So I was like, oh, please make this be good. And then it wasn't, and that was awful. This is like, yes, okay, this deserves to be good. So all they need to do is make it good, and then I'll be happy.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
And I think Ryan probably would be leaving the show. My hope is that he'll leave on his own terms and not with handles on his ears. So
handles on his ears. His ears turned into evil handles.
People were joking on Twitter or in Gallifrey Base or wherever that the Cybermen spaceships look like they had handlebars on them.
In
the trailer.
I think they do. And you know what? I love that. I want the Cybermen to have giant heads as their spaceships. Have you said? Are you aware of the movie Zardoz?
Was that the Sean Connery one?
Yeah, was Sean Connery's like wearing a red kind of diaper.
Thong, yeah.
But that has a giant floating evil head in it that floats around and like shouts at people. And I'm just hoping that the Cybermen have been watching their early John Borman movies and decided, yes, our spaceships will look like giant heads and they will float about and shout at people.
Excellent.
Excellent. Resistance is futile.
Come to our big cyber head.
The catchphrase of the giant head in Zardoz is the gun is good, the penis is evil. So I very much hope that the cyberheads might shout there that you as go. Well, possibly. Yeah. And for those of our listeners who've not watched Zardoz, I can heartily recommend it. It's a completely crazy, insane movie that Sean Connery sort of made by mistake.
Was Molly Ringwald in that too, or is that a different
No,
one?
Charlotte Rampling
okay.
is in Zardoz. Right. Yeah, she's kind of Sean Connery's love interest in space.
Because Molly Ringwald was in one of these really bad sci-fi movies too in this era.
Yeah, and... she was Space Hunter in the Adventures in the Forbidden Zone, I believe.
Okay. That sounds like a Bob and Doug McKenzie spinoff. But
that's right. A classic. Viewers, if you've not watched Space Hunter: Adventures in the Forbidden Zone, starring Molly Ringwald and some other people, very much worth checking out.
I guess this is what we'll have to do in a couple of weeks. We'll have to break out to the B movies and
yeah, we should. Yeah, I don't know. I mean, actually, this is funny. This was a topic of conversation amongst our fellow podcasters at Gallifrey One. Is like, what do you do when there's no Who? That was actually the topic of the panel of which I was the moderator. Yeah, it's a challenge. It's a challenge for us.
So. You had tweeted out at the end, you had a fantastic LobbyCon. Is there anything you can share?
Well, I had an awesome time. I was up till about 1 o'clock in the morning talking to Scott Gray, actually, which was fantastic. Yeah. Hanging out with Scott and also with Mike Collins and Mike Collins' wife, Bernadette. They went to bed about 10-ish. Uh-huh. And then I had another kind of 3 hours or so hanging out with Scott, which was awesome. He would not be drawn on the whole Mother G conundrum. He kind of tapped his nose, but he was very complimentary that I'd noticed. Mm-hmm. He was telling me that he often gets worried that no one reads the comic strip. Uh-huh. Like you, David, you never read the comic strip. Mm-hmm. He gets worried that no one reads the comic strip in the magazine. And I assured him that I did, and I thought it was fantastic, and I did notice the whole Mother G thing. Mm-hmm. Spoiler alert, I've just got my most recent edition of Doctor Who magazine, and we're still don't really have her identity's not fully revealed. So
she's not pinned down.
Yeah.
But more Mother G stuff in there.
There is more Mother G stuff, and I think it's going to be one of his recurring characters. I was complimenting on him on his... on his kind of long form storytelling. He's a big Marvel fan and, you know, likes the kind of Marvel style of comic book writing where, you know, you kind of place things all the way back and then they arrive like 20 issues forward. And he's likes that kind of storytelling. I really am not a big fan of Marvel at all. I don't really like American comics in that way, but I do find that kind of storytelling very satisfying, the way that he does it in the Doctor Who strip.
Where he hints in something and then pay off much later.
Absolutely, yep, absolutely. Mm-hmm. Which is, and I was saying, you know, I'm so glad that I have all my Doctor Who magazines out on the shelf here in my little apartment, because it means as soon as I remember something that he planted 20 issues ago, I can run to the shelf and rip down the relevant issue and, you know, et cetera, which I kind of enjoy.
Very good.
No, he was a fun guy to spend time with. Again, for those of you who are not currently reading the Doctor Who magazine comic strip, really read it, because it's a lot of fun, gives a lot of, really expands on the characters in kind of very, very satisfying ways. So, and it's Scott Gray, and it's not really his full-time job. He's basically an editor for Panini, and edits various magazines for them, and sort of writes the comic strip, you know, not literally in his part-time, but, you know, he said it's obviously a job that wouldn't be able to keep him alive if that was the only thing he was doing. And similarly with all the artists on the strip as well, people like Mike Collins and Martin Geraghty and Adrian Salmon, they all do other things,
right?
And they illustrate the strip, because they love Doctor Who. And I think that's one of the reasons why it's so good, actually, is because everybody who works on that strip is doing it because they love the show, not because it's their job, and if they don't do it, they won't get paid, sort of thing.
Well, it's why this podcast is so good. We love the show, and we don't get paid.
And we're literally not getting paid for this. Yes, yeah. But I know it was, as I said, just a kind of final wind up for the convention. I had a really good time. A lot of my good time was really to do with meeting more fellow fans and finding some fans who I felt that I could connect with, and kind of enjoying their company, which was again, very rewarding. And also, being able to do some lobby conning and actually, spending time with people who I kind of wanted to spend time with, the kind of the people that I'd gone to the con to meet, basically.
Right.
I mean, it did help that, and he'd agree with me if he's listening to this podcast, Scott Gray wasn't the most well-known person at the convention. So I was able to completely monopolize his time because no one else was.
Right.
But, that's fine. I think he'd be fine with that analysis.
Well, hopefully it did helped him pass his time and
he'd never been to LA before, so he was kind of thrilled to be. And I think again, in general, I think it's a pretty good natured convention, and I think people sort of enjoy it. So yeah.
Well, good.
I'm probably going to be buying myself a ticket for next year, I think.
Oh, wonderful! That's great.
Yeah, I think so. Yeah. Have to clear it with my wife a little bit, but anyway,
Maybe Amanda would like to come down.
Yeah. She's not a great one for that kind of behavior. But I have said, she could just sit by the pool, and then I could do all the conventioneering,
or she can go into town or whatever too.
Go into town. It's LA. There's plenty to do. It's a big town with plenty to do.
You have the hotel room.
Absolutely. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yep.
Right.
I think that's all.
Yep, and we're recording this rather late since you had stuff to get done after Gallifrey 1. So we're recording this on a Thursday evening. We'll get that out here in time for the Ascension of the Cyberman, I think is the next one up.
Ascension of the Cyberman.
Which is pretty much just the rise of the Cyberman, isn't it?
It is, but rising in a kind of religious way, though. So the Cyberman rising up to heaven, I guess. Who knows?
So
we will find out on Sunday.
Yep, it is a first of a two-parter, or the middle episode of a three-parter, depending on how you want to look at it.
That's true. Absolutely. Yeah. Good stuff. Well, we will we'll see what we think.
All right. Well, thank you for listening to episode 148 of the Metabulous Tube podcast. I have been talking with Ben.
I have been talking with David.
And until next time, goodbye.
Excellent.